I think I will start. Today's lecture is based on an article. In fact, what is a problem of? I'm coming from Brazil. Mostly I write in Portuguese. So much of my, of who we are writing and studying in Latin America, particularly this field of research work, we don't exchange so much as we could, no, because it's a kind of peripheral or marginal languages. So much of the lectures before, with exception of the first one, which is now being published in this next issue of the Journal of Hindu Studies. In fact, it's online already, the first lecture I gave on Vedanta. But the other two are based on other research work, which partially has been published, but in Portuguese language. But this one, no. So if afterwards you are interested in following it more closely, the title of the article is Bhattahari's Linguistic Ontology and the Semantics of Atmanepada. And this is in Sophia. Sophia is a journal of philosophy of science, philosophy of religion, better, published by Springer. So if you just go enter there in the internet, 2014, April, this article is there. So I don't need to send you again the text, because the complete version and the argument is there in this article. So today I'm going to speak about Atmanepada. In fact, it was something that right from the beginning of my Sanskrit studies, I was very much perplexed with. What was, after all, Atmanepada? Because we used to have a kind of general semantic definition of Atmanepada, but while translating, usually we do not pay so much attention to those specific semantic details, and particularly its difference from Parasmaipada in those verbs where both alternatives are there. So I'll just read the text, some 40 minutes, and then we'll just interact. The distinct function of Atmanepada in Sanskrit language has remained a sort of mystery since my early studies of the language. A suspicion rose gradually to the fact that what Richard Solomon calls the process of decay of Atmanepada as a distinct semantic category since Paninian times reflected either an interchangeable usage along with Parasmaipada, where you don't make much difference, or a fixation of its original meaning in specific verbal forms. So you would have Atmanepada only for some verbal forms. Was perhaps this process a diachronic development whose background involved a much wider scope of semantic implications? According to Panini's traditional teachings, Atmanepada is described as comprising verbal endings meant for situations where, I'm quoting, the results of the acts are intended for the agent. Kartra bhipraye kriya phale. If historical research on the linguistic origins of Indo-Aryan language is correct in attributing to Vedic Atmanepada a scope of usage which potentially involved all verbal forms, that is, pre-Paninian, it will always remain an important and vital question to inquire into its distinctive semantic implications lying dormant in each and every surviving form of classical and current usage of exclusive or interchangeable. It means where Atmanepada is only for a few verbs, or it is interchangeable in a few or lesser case with Parasmaipada. Equally relevant is the investigation of the analytical forms, prepositional or explanatory, developed over the centuries, meant to express in a rather frozen or crystallized way that which formerly constituted a possible layer of meaning of each and every verbal form. To assess the larger implications and subliminal meaning of what could indeed mean the descriptive expression of the results of the acts are intended for the agent, as Panini has defined, one should perhaps take the inquiry beyond the realm of linguistics, which has been the dominant approach to modern Sanskrit studies, and get inside the territory of philosophy, and more specifically, philosophy of meaning, as a purportful approach of traditional Indian philosophy, language, philosophy of language. Accordingly, a legitimate and contextualized philosophy of meaning lies at the heart of grammatical studies in the Indian tradition, and its major expression is undoubtedly Bhartahari's Vakya Padiya. Accordingly, the present lecture is divided into two parts. In the first part, I will present a general framework of Bhartahari's philosophy of language, understood as a rational and soteriological undertaking. And in the second part, I will try to argue that the specific powers or capacities, he called samarthya, of Atmanipada, as traditional laid down in Bhartrhari linguistic system, includes a unique semantic disposition to suggest oneness that could be of instrumental relevance in that noble soteriological undertaking. Now, expanding from Panini and Patanjali's, the commentator of Panini, primary commitment to the correct ascertaining of the meaning of Vedic words as a subsidiary task to the performance of ritual and consequently to the subjective accumulation of religious merits and the subsequent attainment of Svarga as existential welfare, Bhartrhari postulates that the correct understanding of the ultimate meaning of all linguistic functions should lead one to the realization of the supreme aim of life, apavarga or moksha. So he's going to amplify, let us say, the traditional scope of the grammatical studies according to Panini and Patanjali. The non-dual linguistic ontology, Shabdadvaitavada, that lies beyond all subjective paradisiacal goals and all subject-object dichotomies is therefore that ultimate goal and not just the rituals and the attainment of Svarga. The Upanishadic Brahman, Jnanakanda, emerges as the non-dual absolute, the unitarian principle subsuming all cosmic manifestations, both Laukika as well as Alaukika, in that case, the Svarga, as a process of ontic differentiation between words and their inherent meaning, and between the elements of a tripartite scheme comprising the experiencer, the experienced, and the experience, grounded on the ontological oneness of Brahma, the only self-subsistent reality. The linguistic differentiations establishes the multiplicity of a world marked by sets and subsets of event experiences expressible through the centrality of verbal forms involving the so-called conditioning factors. That's the word he uses for all grammatical units, upadis, such as nominative subjects, accusative objects, and their modes of manifestation, time, space, aspect, diathesis, number, gender. So all the constituents of what we call the grammatical units. These factors are experienced by the common man in ignorance as self-subsistent and reified entities, subjects and objects. And after proper scrutiny, those factors are unveiled as dependent appearances or emanations, modal forms of Brahma. That's the peculiar and radical task proposed by Bhartrhari. Over and above the meaning of particular units, sentence or words, which are more immediately committed to ego-centered ritual actions leading to the acquisition of worldly and meta-worldly goals, there is another level of meaning, a meaning subjacent to all meanings, pervading each and every linguistic sentence, where the worldly and paradisiacal distinctions such as the knower and the known, the doer and the done, the experience and the experienced are transcended. In other words, there is a supreme meaning, paramartha, where conventional linguistic difference between word and their inherent meanings are ultimately sublimated. Thus, Bhartrhari philosophy of language commits itself through analytical procedure to unveiling what has always been there as the ultimate substratum of all linguistic events, Brahma. And substantial grammatical factors, the upadis, conditions its appearance as a world of words and meaning. If traditional outlook thinks of grammarians as dealers of sounds and meanings rather than objective realities, Bhartrhari lends this maximum a new corollary. It is so, they deal with sounds and meanings, because the so-called, inverted comma, objective reality is itself an appearance or an emanation of or coextensive to linguistic differentiations between words and meanings. So language is a world-giver experience. Grammar becomes in Bhartrhari's hands a soteriological undertaking, moksha sadhana, where traditional analysis sentences into their constituent elements goes beyond the topical understanding of particular linguistic events by combining meanings of different words, and whose efficacy resides in its capacity to prompt one to act ritually. Instead, for Bhartrhari, the analytical procedure is above all and ultimately a means to unveiling the ontological interdependence that binds together all the constituents of all the sentence, understood as modal appearance of the ever-present foundational ground of the world, Brahman. This soteriological discipline, described by Bhartahari as Shabda Purva Yoga, literally the soteriological path leading to the realization of what lies beneath the word, commits Vyakarana, the grammar, with the realization of the highest goal of Apavarga, Brahma Prapti, through detachment, beyond the ephemeral goals of Abhyudaya. Abhyudaya would be the goals limited to the acquisition of Svarga, postulated by his predecessors. The principles above are eminently enshrined in the overall project of Vakyapadiya, which is the magnus opus of Bhartahari. In part one, known as Brahmakanda, Bhartahari sets forth the linguistic nature of Upanishadic Brahman, the world principle, seed of cosmic appearance emanation, and the innermost essence of all subjectivity, the Supreme Self. In part two, known as Vakyakanda, Bhartahari deals with the smallest units of meaning, the sentence. Following Panini and Patanjali's grammarian tradition, he challenges the Mimamsaka's position by positing the sentence as an indivisible unity of meaning, a khanda paksha, which is grasped by the listener as a flash of light, you know, as the word spota. Also another word which is used is pratibha, which is going subsequently to be narrated by Abhinav Gupta, a fundamental concept for Abhinav Gupta also, which is a sort of intuitive perception. In other words, the meaning of a sentence is not grasped through the gradual sequence of added meanings. So when you hear, no, that was a traditional Mimamsaka explanation, so you have different elements and you're going to add and sum, establish a relation between those elements and understand the meaning of the words or the sentence. So it is not in this way that we understand meanings of sentences, but by an immediate and unitarian flash of signification that gets gradually clarified, unveiled by the temporal sequence of uttered words. So what it means to say is that at the time I pronounce a sentence, the additional word which I mean uttering is going to clarify the basic intuition which comes and is prompted by the initial enunciation of the sentence. So you have a unit, let us say, of meaning to be clarified and explained by the plurality of terms which are present in the sentence. In the Bhartahari's words, the sentence is an indivisible unity of meaning, bereft of any expectation, which is present through individual words marked by mutual expectation, that is interdependence. The word akanksha is that word in Sanskrit. So if you just say, for instance, the subject is expecting an object. And when you utter an object, the object is expecting a subject, and so on. So the sentence is that unity of mutually expectant elements and components. This unitarian and autarkic character of the sentence vis-à-vis their constituent elements constitutes an analogical, microcosmic, inverted comma, reflection of the foundational relationship between Brahma and the plurality of the world or of words and meanings. Here lies the logical and necessary connection between the first two parts of the Vakyapadiya. The ontological tenets posited in the first Brahmakanda supply the parameters of reference for the apprehension of the indivisible meaning of any sentence discussed in the second. Accordingly, the Sphota theory, flash of meaning, now translating literally, presented in the first part as propositive of Brahman, as the ultimate unitarian and autarkic word principle and substratum of world manifestation, as the ultimate word meaning beneath all words and sounds, becomes the ontological foundation for Bhartahari's descriptive grammar of the second part. And in a similar manner that the oneness of Brahma involves the non-duality of word and meaning, the unicity in each and every sentence, that is the flash of meaning it carries, echoes the same mystery of world appearance. The meaning of the individual words, though apparently linked to externalities, does in fact spring from and in concomitance with the uttering of the sentence. It means that we have relational meanings. It is in the context of this relation which is brought by language, just like a network which establishes and constitutes a world of experience, that the words acquire meanings, individual meanings. Consequently, the realization of this flash of meaning involves necessarily the act of self-detachment from presumptive, reified meanings of individual words. In the words of Bhartahari, This is the explanation of the meaning of the sentence. When the different words of a sentence have their meanings freed from outer determinations, a flash of meaning is produced. So you have to get rid, in some sense, to understand the meaning of the attachment to the specific meanings of each of the terms, which involves, therefore, a certain process of self-detachment. The word meanings become then the instruments to present the meaning of the sentence. In part three, known as Padakanda, Bhartahari undertakes the analysis of each and every component of the sentence, Pada. So it starts with Brahma, saying that it is the purport of any expression of language. It means it's a world-giving experience as Brahma. The totality, the unity which is brought by language is Brahma. In the second part, he speaks about the structure of the sentence. And in the third part, he's going to study each of the components of the sentence. It's called Padakanda. He undertakes the analysis of each and every component of the sentence. Though ultimately lacking autonomy to convey meaning on their own, individual words are nevertheless assumed by the common man as if bearing an immediate connection to external self-subsistent entities of a presumed, inverted comma, objective world. Bhartahari's process of linguistic analysis seeks to contextualize and relativize their roles by positing their subservience to the meaning-bearing sentence. The basic tool to accomplish this task is the notion of akanksha, we have mentioned already. The difference between individual words and the sentence, and that the meaning of the former is marked, it means the words is marked by expectancy. That is, it's a meaning that depends ultimately on the relationship of that word with other words, whereas the meaning of the latter is free from expectancy, nirakankshata, the sentence. Notions such as time, space, action, now this is a list of factors which he studies, time, kala, space, dik, action, kriya, the means of accomplishing action, sadhanas, diathesis or upagraha, which is going to be important because it's here where parasmaipada and atmanepada are going to be studied, and the others are presented as desubstantialized linguistic categorical powers, shakti, or conditioning factors, upadis. They'll help in the process of a sentence meaning creation and ultimately of Brahma manifestation. So different parts of grammar are upadis, are the presentation of Brahma, né, under a kind of appearance of plurality. As in the Vedantic tradition, we use that word, Shankara uses that word upadi also, to speak about Brahman appearing as a plurality of the world. Particularly relevant for our analysis are the intimate links between the fourth and the fifth factors, which I've listed here, sadhana and upragraha. The understanding of their combined efficacy implies one's relinquishing of any realistic claim to the notion of substance, dravya, which is doomed consequently to be relegated as subaltern category, submissive to the commanding designs of verbal centrality. Accordingly, the notion of kriya acquires a unique prominence within the various components of the sentence. For its character as an unreifiable event, it means I'm talking about the verb, specifically the word and the grammatical sense of the of that word called verb, pointing to an event or process, kriya is the privileged locus of the meaning of the sentence, that is, the center to which all the remaining components of sentence converge. In other words, say Subramaniam Iyer, a traditional, well-known translator and commentator of Bhartahari, within the sentence, it is the verb which chiefly expresses the main meaning. It means we do not act, we participate in actions. So there is an act and there are objects and subjects which take part in actions. The three parts of Vakyapadiya have been correctly correlated to the three stages of Vaj, that is, the three levels of word meaning as described by Bhartahari in part one and explained in greater detail in his own commentary known as Vritti. The first stage, the main subject of Brahmakanda, is designated as Pashyanti. So the three levels of meaning of a word in the context of Bhartahari, which are three levels of ontological structure of the world. So this is the first, which is dealt with in the first part of the Vakyapadiya. Brahmakanda is called the highest level, called Pashyanti. Subramaniam Iyer explains in these words, Pashyanti, the first stage, is one and absolutely free from all differentiation, is the idea of unity behind everything. between word and meaning and the sequence between word and meaning. It is beyond all actions of correctness, and it is beyond all worldly usage. It is indivisible, it is the inner light, it is a subtle word, and it is imperishable. It is a pre-mental state. The second stage, the main subject of Vakya Khanda, so the second part of the text, is designated by Bhartrhari as Madhyama. In Iyer's words, this Madhyama is a purely mental stage and is not audible to others. It is accompanied by the subtle function of breath, and so it appears to have a sequence, being one with the mind, which is sequenceless, and it is also sequenceless, therefore, but appears to have sequence. In it, I'm quoting here, word and meaning are differentiated from each other, but each one is still a unit. We could compare this to the Swapnavastha in the traditional interpretation of Gaudapadacharya and Shankaracharya. It means it's a dream world in the sense that it is a pure linguistic world where, though there are differentiations, they live all them together, just like in the dream. This is the mental stage because the states emphasize its association with buddhi. The third stage, the main subject of Padakanda, is designated by Bhartrhari as Vaikari. In Iyer words, it is the externalized stage. It is the word that is audible to others. It is highly mixed up or uttered in distinct phenomena. It can have correctness and it can be without it. Its association is with breath and the vocal organs. Here, both word and meaning are fully differentiated, not only from each other, but within each other there is full differentiation. So there is the word and the meaning. Not only differentiation between different words or the meanings of different words, between word and meaning. Meaning understood as an object. It means a reality outside the context of the linguistic expression itself. As a corollary of the above, one should note that the three stages propounded by Bhartrhari should not be understood as corresponding necessarily to different types of words or discourses, but fundamentally to different levels of realization of meaning, which recur in each and every human linguistic utterance. It means that the highest level Brahma is never absent in whatever dimension my awareness, my consciousness is set in a particular moment. So there are distinct epistemological levels rather than levels of reality. From an ontological perspective, Bhartrhari's three-partition of Vaj reflects a dynamics of manifestation of Brahman into layers constitutive of world multiplicity. From an epistemological perspective, on the other hand, it reflects a reverse process from Vaikari to Pashyanti, consisting of a cognitive sadhana that enables existential ignorance marked by a natural disposition to falsely posit substantive otherness, dvaita, to redeem itself and realize the unicity of Brahma. These two fundamental aspects, one ontological and another epistemological, define, in a very technical sense, the precise meaning of the Vedas to Bhartrhari. In the first, Veda denotes an entity which is identical with Prano, the Om, the language principle, and Brahma, Om. And in the second, Veda denotes the specific body of literature dedicated to the teaching of Dharma and Moksha. It is in this later sense that the Vedas assume definitely the character of a propedeutics of salvation. Akluchkar, another great specialist of Bhartrhari, states, Vedic Dharma is for Bhartrhari the meaning directly leading to some kind of elevation and indirectly to attainment of Brahma or spiritual liberation. The first dimension is descriptive of Dharma stricto sensu as ritual action, which is a traditional sense of the word Dharma, undertaken by an interested agent seeking to obtain a paradisiacal condition, svarga. And in the second is descriptive of Dharma lato sensu, which includes additionally the path leading to the ultimate condition beyond desires of the realization of Brahma. Therefore, the distinctive knowledge revealed by the Vedas, not known or available elsewhere, this is the world apurva, constitutes in Bhartrhari's views the sadhana that enables man to undertake the reverse process of world manifestation. That is, to move from Vaikari, the lower, the given, the natural conditions of existence, where we understand words as different objective realities, to Madhyama, and then finally to Pashyanti levels of Shabda Pramana. We could therefore state that the gradual ascension towards the two superior levels of non-dual Shabda constitutes essentially a Vedic undertaking, comprising Dharma and Moksha Purusartha. So what here I have is that the tradition of the Vedas, classified usually as Apaurusheya, means eternal, has these two dimensions, which are two dimensions of navigation, of surfing within language itself. One is accomplished through the ritual acts, and the highest level accomplished through the analysis, which is undertaking here, of the ultimate meaning or sense of the words. So it is a kind of journey within language itself. This being so, the analytical investigation of Bhartahari's Vyakarana is much more than just a matter of scientific analytical description of linguistic components. It is a method that points to and prompts one to realize the unity beyond these components. Or behind, I'm sorry, not beyond. The unity behind these components. The argument I used to advance about the semantic implications of Atmanepada are grounded on those descriptive but also prospective principles that underscores the Vakyapadi. It means whenever I want to show the syntactical correlations between words in a sentence, I'm not just reifying or attempting to reify certain kind of word within that particular function, but establish that that function is related to other functions, and therefore pointing out, stressing the interdependent character of the language as a world given experience. So the arguments I wish to advance about the semantic implications of Atmanepada are grounded on those descriptive prospective principles that underscore the Vakyapadiya. Considering Bhartahari's general procedure of entrusting grammatical categories and subcategories with the role of conditioning factors, upadhi, at the service of disclosure of sentential meanings and ultimating the meaning of all the meanings, Brahma, the specific chapter on upagraha, which is the term that we may translate as diathesis, where Parasmaipada and Atmanepada are dealt with, sometimes they are translated as voice. It's not a correct term in my opinion. Atmanepada and Parasmaipada are not voices. They are diatheses, is one aspect, sometimes another word in technical modern linguistic tradition. The specific chapter on upagraha, which is a term which he uses therefore to discuss technically in Sanskrit this distinction between Atmanepada and Parasmaipada, derives its unique relevance from the fact that the verbal endings it deals with, Atmanepada and Parasmaipada, reverberate in a specific relevant way the linguistic interdependence between the totality of the terms of a sentence. In fact, the centrality of verbal forms, kriya, in defining the smallest unity of meaning, vakya, entrusts diathetic endings, which is exactly what it means in technical sense, Atmanepada and Parasmaipada, with a significant role in the process of proper conveyance of intended meaning. In particular, the case of Atmanepada presents, as we'll see below, a singular capability to suggest convergence and unity of the nominal forms involved, which are the subject, the nominative role, and its objects, the accusative and other roles, eventually favoring ontological desubstantialization of some of them or even of them all. This fact could prove significant in the gradual process of philosophical disclosure of Vach as world principle, that is, one's vertical ascent from the Vaikari to the Madhyama and Pashyanti levels of meaning. To understand the implications of this possibility in the Vakyapadiya, one has to briefly revisit the grammatical textual tradition on Atmanepada. The specific discussion of Atmanepada in the Vakyapadiya appears in the part 3, the Pada Kanda, under a separate section called Upagraha Samudesha. Samudesha means a division, a chapter. And Upagraha is the theme. Chapter, I could translate, on verbal diathesis. As I'm saying, many modern commentators or translators translate it as voices. But I don't think it's a correct term. And more specifically to the diathesis involving Atmanepada and Parasmaipada endings. The word upagraha, used by Bhartahari to nominate the section under evaluation, was inherited from the grammarian tradition as a designation to specific suffix meant to denote peculiar semantic diathesis of verbal actions. Whereas in some circles it meant exclusively Atmanepada, in others it meant the various nuances of meaning and usages between Atmanepada and Parasmipada. In both the circles, what surfaces the main point of discussion is not a general description of Sanskrit padas, but rather the perplexity surrounding the dialectics between Atmanepada and Parasmipada. The original coextensivity of usage between Atmanepada and Parasmipada in potentially all verbal forms, and the former's clear distinction from passive or impersonal or reflexive meanings, that means that Atmanepada cannot be construed, that's why it's not a middle voice, for example, as is sometimes translated, from passive, impersonal, or reflexive meanings, tended to make Atmanepada a kind of obscure double of Parasmipada. In other words, if Parasmipada appeared as the default active form, meant to express interactive relations between subjects and objects, the possible nuances of those same relations, which demanded the usages of Atmanepada, remained relatively unclear. Bhartr Hari's decision to dedicate a specific chapter on the matter seems therefore to be determined by the desire to bring clarity to the usages and meanings of Atmanepada vis-à-vis those of Parasmipada. At the time, his time, when coextensivity was restricted to fewer verbal forms and the exclusive usage of one or the other did not seem to properly adjust to traditional held semantic distinctions. The importance and complexity of the matter is stressed on by the commentator Elaraja in his work Prakirna Prakasha. It means is an interpretation, a comment on Bhartrahari's Vakyapadiya. He says that Upagraha, and more specifically, differences between Atmanepada and Parasmipada are a matter endowed with an alaukika character. I want to stress this point. It means extraordinary, meaning that this is perhaps that which is recognized in grammar only and not by the ordinary man in the world. Quotation. Bhartr Hari's position on the specific aspects of Atmanepada follows the main principles formulated by Panini and Patanjali. He opens the chapter of Upagraha with words that clearly underscore his main concern with Atmanepada. So though it is a chapter to speak about both, no? He mentions only in the beginning Atmanepada, since he omits the explicit mention to the main term of comparison, that is Parasmipada. He says, that difference in meaning, which is understood from the Atmanepada substitute, and the other substitute is called Upagraha. This and the next six slokas reinstate the grammarian position of Atmanepada. Its main points, eloquently explained by commentator Elaraja, with an emphasis on the suggestive rather than expressive nature of both the aesthetics endings, are summarized by Yer in the following words. The most important and distinctive notion attributed to Atmanepada or Parasmipada suffix is that the fruit of the action denoted by the root coming to the doer or going to someone else. The action of one who performs a sacrifice in order to go to heaven is yajate, which is a term which we use in the sacrificial tradition, in the ritual tradition. Yajate is a Atmanepada of yaj, no, sacrifice. So the action of one who performs a sacrifice in order to go to heaven is yajate, while that of the priest who officiated merely to get his fee is yajati. Here is the principle of the word yajamana, which in fact is also a present participle of Atmanepada. Yajamana is the sacrificer, the one in whose benefit the sacrifice is done. I may engage many people, I may pay for many people to participate, but the karmic positive or negative consequence of those actions is determined by the one who is, let us say, the yajamana, the sacrificer himself. So he is yajate, and the others may be yajati, in the sense that the fruit of those actions are not going to accrue for them. In the former case, the fruit, it means yajate, Atmanepada, the fruit heaven of the action denoted by the root yaj, comes to the doer of that action, while in the latter it goes to someone else. The two actions differ from each other in scope and aim. These two shades of the same meaning come under Upagraha. The fact that ultimately everybody acts at all times for this or her own sake demands an ad hoc explanation. He says, but in the case of the priest, he also somewhat is interesting. So he is also sacrificed for some personal interest. What justifies the usages of Atmanepadina is a situation where the intrinsic results of an action actually accrues to the doer. The priest, in the example above, is not expected to obtain the intrinsic fruit of the ritual, that is paradise. What he gets, the salary, is extrinsic to the act. Though he may get something, he may be doing that because he gets something, but not that which is intrinsically related to the particular action at stake. Similarly, the doer of the action whose intrinsic results are intended need not be the actual performer of the acts. He may just cause others to perform them and still be the recipient of the results. That's why in Sanskrit we have such a reiterated use of the causative. The causative is an agent. He makes others do for him, for his sake. So you may also, in the causative, have an Atmanepada meaning. Sense, let us say, semantics. No, it means either you use a causative or you may use a Atmanepada without causative, but meaning, in fact, when you say, I sacrifice, I may not sacrifice directly, but I make someone do the sacrifice for my sake. In that case, though I'm not doing myself directly the action, so it would be a kind of causative, I'm using the Atmanepada just to convey that idea that whether I'm doing or not, whatever is going to happen is because or accrues the result for me. Bhartrahari's clarification of the grammarian tradition on Atmanepada takes a decisive step with introduction, and here it is the point of the argument, of the concept of Samvidhana. Not very much noticed because a third part of Bhartrahari is not, in fact there is one translation of IA, but it has not been very commented or discussed. And he adds to the traditional Panini definition and Patanjali's commentary as the result accruing to the agent as definition of Atmanepada, another concept, which I think is decisive for us to understand, what for Bhartrahari has a certain implication is overall concept of oneness of the Vedic language as presenting Brahma. So is the concept of Samvidhana. It is described as a constitutive component of all actions involving Atmanepada. So for him, Atmanepada is not just an action in which the results accrue to the subject of the action, directly or indirectly. But it involves what he says, Samvidhana. More than an absolute innovation, it brings clarity and helps unveiling the profound and deeper implications of Panini's seminal postulation. Again, repeating, the results of the acts are intended for the agent. Generally translated as Samvidhana, the act of making provisions or making arrangements, Samvidhana. Remember the word vidhi also in the context of the Vedic tradition. It means that the injunctions which are, let us say, provided by the Vedas himself. Samvidhana, so it's a kind of convergence of a plurality of actions or sub-actions which are involved in the unity of purpose. So the act of making provisions, Samvidhana, dominates the remaining part of Vakyapadiya's Upahara Samudesha, that part on the Upahara, it means Parasmaipada and Atmanepada, as a main element to define what Atmanepada is. Specially relevant for the understanding of its major implication are shlokas 8 and 9. He says, sometimes from verbs such as pach, means to cook, one understands the meaning of Samvidhana, making provisions, making arrangements, just as one also understands from them other actions like putting the pot on the fire, which are caused by the Samvidhana. The expression, the expression which is the definition of Panini, the results of the acts are intended for the agent, in the sutra implies a particular action. Indeed, an agent of such action enjoys the fruit aimed through the performing of the action of cooking, in the consequence or in consequence of that action. In the sequence, Bhartrahari reminds the reader that despite its original all-pervasive character in the course of time, the power of making provision was extinguished in some roots, in the sense that for those roots where Atmanepada ceased to have a kind of possible application, where it becomes specialized only in Parasmaipada. He states, For some verbs, the capacity to signify a particular sort of action, that is, atmanipad as samvidhan, as making provisions, is suppressed, while there are others for which this does not hold. So is, in fact, bringing again the genealogy, the history of the development of the Sanskrit tradition, where atmanipada is going to lose, let us say, the capacity to express this dimension of samvidhana in some of the verbs. And that's why today when we learn Sanskrit from the first time, we are told that some verbs are parasmaipada, others atmanipada, and some others less are both alternatives. So he is saying that there was a kind of fixation in some, a certain particular meaning, whether atmanipada or parasmaipada, but that is a suppression, let us say, of this element of capacity to samvidhana. Thus, according to Bhattrahari, atmanipada expresses the idea of making arrangements for the performance of an action, the ultimate result of which one would enjoy oneself. In other words, it is only when the action of cooking is accompanied by the act of samvidhana, by its agent, that the agent enjoys the fruit of action. Therefore, the idea of the fruit of action coming to the agent does not hang merely on the agent's intention to enjoy it. What actually conditions the possibility of the results of the acts are intended for the agent is that the agent's intentionality is accomplished through an act of samvidhana, means bringing together. But what does samvidhana actually means or implies? My contention is that samvidhana entrusts atmanipada with a uniquely suggestive character of eventive, of purportful unity, ekarti bhava. That is a distinctive capability to indicate the underlying unity of a plurality of terms involved in a particular action or sentence, in accordance with Bhartahari's Spota principle. All differences presupposes a unity. A fundamental idea here, no? It means that you cannot have even the notion of difference unless there is an underlying unity permitting even the awareness of difference. Otherwise, difference would never arise as difference. Some would just have discrete existences, that's all, but never have the idea of difference. Accordingly, the idea of an agent who commits himself or herself to making provisions, making arrangements, makes him or her much more than just one among other intervenient factors. Such an agent becomes a stage director, a producer, one who brings things together. Samagri Sanghatana. Bring things together. Who directs the various characters involved in a way that brings unity of focus and purpose. For that, he is the consciousness of the whole underlying all procedures. And finally, on account of that, he is also the so-called beneficiary of the fruits of the action as the center of convergence and meaning of all the components involved. It seems in the end that this suggestion of personal reward, since it's not going to matter in the ultimate sense of moksha, ends up being secondary. It means I have a motivation for personal benefit, but the action which requires personal benefit involves a certain plurality. And in the end, is the awareness which is brought of unity that this particular action involves that is going to matter in the ultimate sense. The suggestions of oneness has a distinct relevance in Bhattrahari's soteriological approach to the grammarian tradition, and more specifically, in the context of the reverse process of climbing upwards the three levels of vach. In this way, atmanipada understood as samvidhana presents a semantic capability to point to existential events that reverberate more intensely than others the oneness underlying all mundane multiplicity. As earlier described, the mundane level, vaikari, is, quoting, one where both the words and meanings are fully differentiated, not only from each other, but within each of them, their full differentiation. So between different meanings between the different words, it means difference between words, and difference between each word and its meaning. The presumption in ignorance that there are many substantial differentiated meanings, that is, meanings crystallized as things, and as much corresponding words. Sentences, therefore, tend to be understood as expressive of relations between things. And relations tend to be treated as circumstantial rather than constitutive properties of things. It means I may be in relation, I may not be in relation. In this context, the semantic difference between parasmaipada and atmanepada could be stated as follows. The first, that is, the sentence, Devadatta cooks rice for someone else to eat, is expressive of situations where the subjects or the agents act over objects, but the fruit of those actions does not accrue to the former. The circumstantiality of relations here is here found to be a mere incidentality, because as the fruit of the action accrues to a third party, subject and agent, and subject and object, it means agent and object, have reduced interaction and consequently are left intact in their presumptive ontological separateness. The second Atmanepada, that is, the sentence where it says Devadatta cooks rice for himself, however, presents a significant difference. Being expressive of situations where subjects act over objects and the fruit of those actions does accrue to the former, Atmanepada tends to evoke participation of the object in the destiny of the subject. Subject and object share a unity of purpose in that very action, which is made possible because of the stage direction or the arrangements, Samvidana, provided by the former. The circumstantiality of relations is here found to be productive of an enhancement of the subject represented by the acquisition of something new as a result of that interaction. It will be a new person, either being born in the Svarga, etc. There's a transformation of the subject. When we speak about acquiring something, that acquisition means a transformation. And that's one of the very important meanings and senses of the transmigratory process. Sometimes we tend to look the transmigration as the continuation of something. In the Indian tradition, particularly Indian philosophical critical tradition, the idea of the transmigration is of transformation. In fact, it lends the idea of non-permanence rather than continuity. I understand that in the Western tradition, particularly in theosophical discourse and many other Kardecist discourse also, the idea of reincarnation end up being a reification of the ego. When you say, I have many lives, it means that my ego is going to be perpetuated. Well, traditionally, the critical discourse of the transmigration territory and the idea why I don't want to transmigrate is exactly the opposite, is that when I speak about other life, I'm speaking about a critic of the idea of permanence of the ego as of now, as of this moment. So it means that there is no permanence for the ego as of now. So the idea of being born in heaven, no, which is, let us say, the putative goal of all Vedic rituals, is understood as transformation. And this transformation results exactly for this arrangement, for this convergence of different things. If he would not be in relation to different things, he would not be able to transform itself. He would remain always the same. So the circumstantiality of relations is here found to be productive of an enhancement of the second. The subject which is going to have the paradise is the result of these relations. It's not the same in which he used just instrumentally, circumstantially those relations. No, those relations and the Samvidana which propitiated this process was transformative of his being. So the object here is not a mere instrumentality, but the existential goal of the agent. Consequently, the awareness of unity assumes form of an inflated agent. Inflated means that he is transformed, consuming, in inverted comma, the intended object. The unity of all terms tends, however, to remain subject-centric rather than verbal-centric. It is an ephemeral evocation of oneness, that is, a unity that ultimately renders service to the reification or inflation of a presumptive separateness between subject and agent, because we are still thinking about someone who is going to get the paradise. The ephemeral evocation of Samvidana unit, making provisions or bringing things together in the mundane context of Vaikari, befitting Artha and Kama Purusharthas, represents a shadow of the paradigmatic dimension of lasting unity that rules entirely the Vedic injunction actions of the Dharma and its deeper cognitive dimension of moksha, which are constitutive, in Bhartarhari's opinion, of the sadhana that enables man to ascend to Madhyama and Pashyanti levels of Shabda Brahma. To understand this, one needs to remember first that the putative goal of all Vedic dharmic injunctions is Svarga. Remember, I don't know if someone has attended my second lecture, but it has to do with this. To understand this, one needs to remember firstly that the putative goal of all Vedic dharmic injunction is Svarga, an afterlife condition to be enjoyed by the sacrificer, or who may be directly or indirectly be the performatic agent of the ritual. By definition, therefore, Vedic injunctions are a matter of Atmanipada, since the fruit of the action is intended for the agent, that is, a sacrificial agent, Yajamana. That explains why the standard example of all injunctive dharmas, Yajeta Svarga Kamaha, one desirous of heaven should sacrifice, takes the verb to Atmanipada. It means it is a potential of transformation. Differently from mundane actions, which may either be conveyed by Atmanipada or Parasmipada, the semantics of Vedic dharmic injunction is essentially and constitutively a matter of Atmanipada. It's very interesting here, this point. It means that whenever you are in matters of karma and dharma, you may use the two words in two alternatives, depending on exactly what you mean by. But whenever you're talking about dharma and the performance of the ritual, the form par excellence is Atmanipada, which excludes, let us for, the idea of non having to gather and arrange the conditions. It functions, therefore, as a model of purportful unity, distinctively activated by Samvidana. What are then the specific aspects of Samvidana presented here? As earlier described, the Madhyama level of Vak, prompted by Vedic propedeutics of Dharma, is a purely mental stage, and it's not audible to others, I'm quoting. In it, word and meaning are differentiated from each other, but each one is still a unit. It reflects a kind of idealistic reversion of Vaikari. It's a purely mental, signals the territory of convergence between a unitarian word, the sentence as one, and a unitarian meaning, the ritual as the unit of action and Svarga as the unit of purpose. It's a new world, in which the plurality of things of mundane world are recreated as desubstantialized entities, that is, as subordinate and subservient terms. Instead of possessing relations, they become possessed by and participate in unitarian word and meaning. It's precisely the congregation of unsubstantial things in that unity of action and purpose that constitutes precisely an act of Samvidana, prompted and directed by the sacrificial agent and the provider par excellence. Let us turn our attention to the fundamental difference between sacrificial and mundane agency of Atmanipada in regard to the actual contents of the unity experienced. Instead of a subject-centric unity represented by an inflated agent who consumes an intended object, the sacrificial agency conforms itself to a verb-sentence-centric unity that prompts a transformative deconstruction of their, means the agents and the objects, presumptive ontological separateness, opening the way for a growing awareness of their existential interdependence. The object's transformative deconstruction is represented by the agent's renunciation to its empirical meaning. It's being a thing, the idea of offering something. By offering it to the sacrificial fire with the following words, this is for Agni, not for me. On the other hand, the agent's transformative deconstruction takes place in a more complex and transverse way. Though the intended svarga is indicative of an initial egocentric motivation, the actual undertaking of actions is projective of the Yajamana's ego disintegration. In fact, the renunciation to mundane object does not have, as a contemporary counterpart, the actual acquisition of the paradise. We have seen this in that lecture number 2, which by definition is to be enjoyed only in next life. Thus, the Yajamana immediate existential condition here in this life is that of a transformed being, an ego subservient to the ritual action itself, resigned to live a life marked by an additional renunciation. The circumstantial and yet extraordinary renunciation to the deferred results of his own ritual actions. That was the argument I've put in second talk. It means you don't merely, when we speak about yaj, sacrifice, you don't merely sacrifice the offerings. You sacrifice the idea that you don't know ever when the results will come. You speak as it's being in another life. So you accept the possibility, which is contra-current to all idea of egoic expression, even when you have an expectation of time, as in the case, for instance, of investments, long-term investments, you have a certain idea, certain determination about the results. In this case, you are asked to do something for the sake of the paradise, which you never know when it's going to get. So during this period of time, in which you are still alive, all your life will be marked by the living here and now with the same things that you have renounced in a certainly different way. Dharma and not svarga, that's what we have argued also there, becomes the actual goal, the purushartha. In other words, the unity of dharmic action as an existential imperative becomes the de facto unity of purpose. In this context, ritual narrative draws itself closely to the pure mental, mantric territory of Madhyama, through reordering the meanings, through a reordering of meanings and de-reification of the terms of intercourse. Empirical reality, the things are neutralized, are put in brackets, and the transcendent reality is not yet produced, the svarga. This unitarian convergence between word and meaning is therefore conveyed by Atmanepada through the Yajamana's act of Samvidana, bringing things together. Sometimes we use to say, regarding the words of the gods themselves, it means gods, we used to say this in the context of the ritual and the sacrifice, the gods are Vedic words. So they are, again, the space where a certain experience of linguistic unity takes place. And that is their role. It means if gods had an externality, perhaps they would not be able to fulfill this role itself. They are there to be pretexts, let us put it in this way, for one to accept this experience of renunciation of mundane goals or goods, so that he is able to experience a certain way of dealing with the same objects, with the same things, with the same mundane realities in a different way. This unitarian convergence of word and meaning is therefore conveyed by Atmanepada through the Yajamana's act of Samvidana, bringing things together, making arrangements, turned out to be a lasting experience of unity, a lasting experience of renunciation, interdependence, and shared cooperative coexistence under the ruling of sentence whole and verbal centrality, in full congruency with the principles of Ekartibhava and Akanksha. So the lasting experience of ritual unity is a transitional doorway for the ultimate realization of its foundational ontology. The ever-present oneness of Shabda Brahma Spashyanti, that is the complete freedom from all sorts of differentiation between words and meanings. For that, one needs to deepen the renunciatory process and set oneself more decisively on the discipline of analytical investigation, vichara, in order to entirely dispel the ignorance constitutive of the world plurality, and so on and so forth. So I'll just conclude summarizing the following. This is one example with Atmanipada of an experience, let us say, where the semantic particular dimension of what we call a grammatical structure is pointing to an experience of unity which is making provisions as Vedic ritual. In conclusion, we can summarize the main points of the article as follows. To effectively embrace Bhartrhari's soteriological concerns, one needs to effectively look at the constitutive elements of the linguistic analysis and their functional dynamics as mystical pointers to the non-dual ontology. So if the grammatical tradition is merely descriptive, presenting the different parts, suppose, of a sentence, he is concerned with the fact that the different parts are, in fact, have, in fact, as intrinsically constitutive the idea of interdependence. So he wants to study the parts from the perspective of the unity that they point to. The article focuses on one of these elements, Atmanepada, the article means the lecture, focus on one of these elements, Atmanipada, and shows that Bhartrhari contributes significantly to clarification of Panini's seminal definition, the results of the acts are intended for the agent, by postulating Samvidana as an intrinsic semantic component of Atmanipada, both in worldly matters, kama and artha, and above all in the Vedic sphere, Varat Manipada is exclusive. You cannot have any description of any sacrificial unless it is in Atmanipada, seems to develop through the suggestive power of Samvidana a singular capacity to convey purportful unity of action and the agent's transformative dynamics of ego decentration through renunciation and reflection. In short, in tune with Bhattacharya's principle, according to which all difference presupposes a unity, abheda purva hi bhedaha. It means that all differences have as an underlying possibility the unit. Atmanipada emerges as a relevant tool to express the gradual process of philosophical disclosure of the oneness of Vach, or in other words, one's ascent from Vekari to Madhyama and to Pashyanti levels of meaning. That's all. I think there is a continuity between this, you know, and what we have seen in that particular second lecture about ritual. You know, because here Atmanipada is being singling out in the context of the ritual action. And it is understood that a ritual action, from the perspective of moksha, as a kind of gradual process or intermediate process, is an experience, a pre-experience of unity. It means it's a dealing within languages. You don't have the swarga for which you aim. You don't have the gods, let us say, in the sense they are the inhabitants of the swarga. And therefore, whatever are the elements constitutives of what you have to do in a ritual action presupposes a certain unity, a certain concerted action, which is samvidana, which takes place only because of what is prescribed in the text itself. That's why in the Vedanta tradition, we used to speak about this level also as a linguistic level. It means the Vedic is a linguistic level of experience. Just like you have the waken, no, the dreamlike, and the deep sleep. So this would be a moment in which, as much as we use, for instance, the analysis of the dream as a kind of suggestions of unity. No? That in the waking, we have the experience of plurality, but in the dream, you are not only one character of the narrative, but you are also the director, because no one else is there but you, let us say. So everything depends on you in that particular experience. The Vedic ritual is a kind of, the reflection over the Vedic ritual, it's what Bhattacharya does, implies a certain experience of being at the same time the director and at the same time a character of a world which is a unique world. And all the things of the awaken, let us say, of the mundane world of kama and artha becomes resignified. It means the same things you renounce to, you are forced to deal with for your entire life in a different way. And you yourself are going to be, because of these demands, acknowledging a possibility of existing without both the way you understand mundane existence, the way you understand privatization of ownership of the objects, so you can deal with objects in a different way, not in a private idea of ownership, and at the same time, renouncing to the perspective of Svarga itself. So you have an immediate experience of unity here and now. From the perspective of moksha, this is what it matters. It means it's as if you make just a kind of pretext of making one believe that Svarga exists to set a kind of step for one to understand that one can live with the things, with the same things in a different way. But from the transmigratory perspective, obviously, we are not denying here that there are paradises, that the persons go to many paradises and come back from this. But ultimately, as we say in the Indian tradition in general, the Svarga is not ultimate. It's not the last word about realization. And therefore, it has a kind of existential function in terms of bringing one's experience. So we used to say that the Vedic world of Dharma itself is a certain way of living a paradise. The immediate paradise which is lived is that transformation of things and yourself in that act. Maybe if you then go through the text which is there, the article, and you can because it's sometimes a technical term. But for me, I don't know, you are students of Sanskrit, no? I've all asked what was the real function of Atmanepan.
But then why is it kept for certain verbs and lost for others? It has to do with meter as well, I think, in later texts as well, that authors choose to use Atmanepada or Parasmaipada just to make it fit the meter.
Yeah, well, I think we have to preserve the idea, the original idea, that all verbs have the potential to Atmanepada. It means that you can always do the same action in these two potential ways. You can do an action in a way that reinforces the ego, or you can do the same action in a completely different way. The narrative of the Bhagavad Gita would explain this. It means that it's not some actions in which you may act with detachment. All actions you may act with attachment, with the same actions. So you are not separating detached actions from other actions. You are separating attitudes within one action. So I think this is a very important testimony in the Sanskrit language about the, let us say, universal character of Atmanepada in all verbs as it was in the beginning, let us put it this way. And I think if you speak about a certain etymology of meaning, it is still there. Now, you have what, as the time goes by, certain verbs are more used for certain acts where this suggestion perhaps is more likely to happen. So when you speak about, for instance, all the Vedic Dharma acts, okay, which are not of other world's acts, they are in this world's acts, they come in Atmanepada. So it means to say that those actions, obviously you have millions of actions, some will be more traditionally used for certain purposes and others for other purposes. So I understand that though the potential is there, you know, since you have crystallized certain actions and certain words, sometimes you have in Sanskrit, for instance, synonymous verbs. Some verbs which are used mostly in the rituals, and those are Atmanepada. And other verbs which usually you translate exactly with the same meaning, but which are used only in Parasmaipada. So here you have an idea in which same meanings can have both, but some specific forms of those meanings have been crystallized in some actions in which, for instance, the Vedic Dharma, the ritual, is not involved. So you're not expected that this experience or this idea of unity is going to be is going to happen. So that would be my justification. Not that potentially they don't have the possibility of having it, but that as the time goes by, specific actions using specific words became more, let us say, involved with this process of experiencing samvidana, experiencing unity.
Could you say something more about moving from Vekari to Madhyama, like the third stage? So say once you move to this second stage where the word and meaning are one, does it mean that this word would no longer, if I think about it, it will no longer refer to, say, a kind of external object in the world anymore? And then if it doesn't, how does it, does Bhaktrihari mean that it would have like a pure meaning in itself?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You see, there is a differentiation between meanings and words, let us put it this way. So you have different words, you have different things. But the meanings of those words are not the meanings you were used to in mundane existence as externalities to the words. And how do you observe this? What it means, external meaning, when you say there is a kind of concrete thing outside the meaning of the word. In this understanding, this is attachment. It means this is a certain way of dealing with that word. You deal with that word, giving it an objective existence. When, and it is related to attachment, is the attachment which gives this reality existence. When you have a method, let us say, we are not entering discussion how the ritual actually operates this in the whole sense, but when you have a procedure which prompts you to think that same thing in a different way, it ceases to be objective. It does not cease to exist. But the new meaning that the same objects of renunciation acquired in the ritual are what we may call purely linguistic, because they are no longer that objective in the sense of attachment.
Okay, but does Bhaktrihari make a distinction between different words? For instance, there are more concrete words and there are more abstract words. Say, like, word referring to water or pot. I mean, these are more like things you can find in the world around us, or words like beauty.
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Even one of the fundamental questions in the whole, even the Mimamsika tradition and also here in the Grammarian tradition, is that the words which are in the Vedas,
mm-hmm.
they are to be understood with their original meanings, in the sense that
mm-hmm.
we have certain meanings, because it's where the meaning is and the objective attachment is that lies the possibility of transformation. So we don't have to think that the words in the Vedas are just metaphors of something else. Otherwise, you use only, you would be severing and separating worlds. You would have a world of mundanity with certain objects, and you have another world of the Vedic words and what it, projects in the case of Svarga. Here what we are talking is this. The same words enter the Vedic text with those original meanings. And within the process of ritual, they are reinvested with new meanings. There is a kind of the ritual is a kind of subversion of meaning. And therefore, that's what makes the thing really revolutionary. And at the same time, makes the thing, the world itself is at stake. So when we speak about Vedic world, we are speaking about a new and fresh look at the world itself, as the objective world itself. And why do we say about there are words without meanings. Sometimes in philosophy of language, Heidegger used to say that sometimes the things which are less useful are the most important. And it's something is like this. What you deconstruct is the usefulness of those objects.
Mm.
But you do not relinquish to them. On the contrary, you find a new existential way of dealing with them. So the words are still there because the words carry the thing. And therefore, one fundamental idea is exactly don't interpret the Vedic words in a metaphorical sense. They come with their original sense, they come with their mundane sense, and it is exactly while dealing with them that I have to rethink my relationship with it. It's very interesting because it's exactly this. I mean, you could speak about different levels of objectivity, let us say, but here what it matters is a break away from a certain way of understanding an object. So I have a word. What I have is a word. Whenever you speak about an object, I could ask, I mean, for a realistic, for an empirical realist, I say, bring me the object without the word. You cannot. So the object is always dialectically related to a word. So the question is, why do I suspect or live in my quotidian life understanding that there is an ontological difference between the word and the object. And here what he's saying is that this is related to attachment. And the experience of the Vedic ritual just like brings the things closer to us. Make us realize that there is an interdependence. Because sometimes we have a difficulty because of the idea of materiality, particularly in the Cartesian tradition. Object here, or denying the object, is not denying things. Object here is the idea of ontological existence outside. Nothing to do with me. That is object.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it is attachment. Because, I mean, in this framework of Indian tradition, objects are perceived as ontologically existing and not interdependent existent because of attachment. So attachment creates not the object. That would be a kind of idealistic proposition. It creates a certain way of the object being. It's very close to the idea of transformation by art, in the sense that here we have, in fact, an artistic process
mm.
in the ritual understood in this way.
Exactly, this process that allows you to see
it's like a reinvestment of meaning.
Mm, exactly.
And a reunion of things. No?
Yes, the process of bringing these things
together
for the purpose. Mm.
It's a kind of, just like you were commenting about this, a kind of revisiting the world in a lab.
Yeah.
The ritual is a kind of world representation,
mm.
for us to rethink it, for us to revisit it. Just like the theater. In fact, the theater, no, in the Natya tradition, is a continuity. Sometimes when we speak about in a kind of evolutionary sense, which I think is absolutely unnecessary, but the model of the theater, of the Natya in the Bharat tradition, is ritual. There are excellent studies about that. I mean, it's not that. I mean, the model of the experience of theatrical abhinaya is ritual. That's why abhinaya is a serious performance. It's not just to make believe. it's make disbelieve about what you think about yourself. No?
Mm-hmm.
It's rehearsing one's own experience. Yes,
I just trying to understand that. It's a gradual understanding of the meaning of the word. Is there a correlation between the word and the Greek logos?
I think so. Fantastic. I'm not working comparatively here, but exactly that, the idea of Samvidhanaya treated in a very concrete and materialistic sense, you know, bringing things together. But when you bring it in the context of word, is exactly this, is logos. Reinterpretation, I think it's an important rescuance by Heidegger, for instance, with regard mm-hmm. to the... I don't think it's only the pre-Socratic tradition, but anyhow, yes, more or less, you know, emphasize the pre-Socratic tradition, is to remind us that logos is reunion.
mm-hmm.
And it's not reunion as bringing things together, it's rescuing the unity of things, which is a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're not construing a unity. You are just realizing the unity that has to be there as a precondition for awareness. The logos is where everything joins together. Now, Heraclitus was going to say, is in logos that everything reconciles itself,
mm-hmm.
and everything meets itself. Yes, it's a logos, it's a logo experience.
It kind of gives you a new appreciation, maybe, too, for the trivium, you know, the grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic. I don't know. Maybe it makes you think.